Jane Hirschfield is a poet and a translator. Through her own poems, we see ourselves anew. And through her translations, we are given a bridge, an elegant bridge, to a century far past and to the hearts and minds of two women who lived in an ancient culture long gone. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. On this edition of Conversations, poet and translator Jane Hirschfield. Jane, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Good. You said sometime back in an essay that the writing of poetry is part making and part following. In this question we might walk around today, what is poetry? Can you talk to me about the difference between making a poem and following the poem?
I can try to. They're very interpenetrating processes, so that it feels a bit as though, to use a fishing analogy, which I often use when I think of where do poems come from, the world is out there in a large lake, but the fish need to be found to come to you. So one feels as though the poem exists, but one has to do something to ask the poem to come. And so you cast a line into this surface, which you don't see the life beneath, but you know it's there. And sometimes one life will come, and sometimes another life will come, but you have to do something in order to ask it in, to invite it in. And so the making might be the first few words of a poem. It might be an image which comes to you, which you know will want to turn itself into a poem. It might be an actual event which triggers a poem, and you simply recognize it. Then, for me, writing is very much a kind of listening that comes after. A listening comes before, a listening comes after. And then it's a dance between listening and speaking what you then hear in words. So a kind of collaborative process always between being active and being receptive. I think that poetry lives in the world, not in us, but it speaks through us. And so our job is to be the proper voice for what wants to speak through us.
Speaks through and in.
Yes.
The poetry is also in you.
Yes.
The poet and the reader, you.
The poetry lives in us, but okay. It exists somewhere beyond us as well and first. We're getting very esoteric
right
at the start, aren't we?
That's all right. Well, there's lots of images that are coming up, which is good. Fishing and the great pool and casting of the line.
Right.
Is your image, that original image you have listened for, or the intention, is that the hook, the bait, the fly on the line that goes out?
One could say that. You can also move it back a step further and say that the bait is our own desire to hear something.
Oh, yes.
That it's simply the act of attention itself, the offering yourself to the world in that way to see what wants to come, the desire to know the world through art, whatever art, to know it through the mind of image, metaphor, story, language, movement, paint. That might be the very first thing, is just to be aware that we want to know the world in many different ways, and art is one of them.
Is that what drew you to poetry?
I started writing so young, I don't even remember what drew me to poetry. You know, from the time I was taught to write, I wrote in order to make poems, make stories. I think it must have been my first grade teacher who must have done something quite splendid. So I blame Mrs. Barlow for it all.
Thank you, Mrs. Barlow.
Exactly.
Jane Hirschfield is our guest, and thanks to Mrs. Barlow. Sounds like the name of a poem. I'll introduce you briefly to her titles so that if you are familiar with Jane Hirschfield, you will recall, and if you're not, you'll have an anchor for this poet. In 1982, Alaya was published, the first collection of her poetry, by the Quarterly Review of Literature Poetry Series, a book now out of print. Of Gravity and Angels is the most recent book of her own poetry, published in 1988 by Wesleyan University Press and more recently by Vintage Classics. No, that's not accurate, is
no.
it? No, I ran away with myself. Of Gravity and Angels
was still published, in print from Wesleyan.
Still in print from Wesleyan University Press. It is the translated poetry we'll talk about in a bit that's out by Vintage, so you'll have to wait for that clue. Two books by Jane Hirschfield of her own poetry, a third coming out in 1994. This is Conversations. Let us go back far into history in our looking again at what is poetry. You, through a lecture and an essay, introduced me to a poet from China, mm-hmm. from the Song Dynasty. Mm-hmm. Perhaps without further ado, would you mind reading his poem about poetry? We have it kind of typed up. The poet's name, Yang Wan Li. He lived during the Song Dynasty, and he wrote this poem, What is Poetry?
A very intriguing poem, and translated in this case by Jonathan Chaves, a wonderful translator of Chinese. Now, what is poetry? If you say it is simply a matter of words, I will say, a good poet gets rid of words. If you say it is simply a matter of meaning, I will say a good poet gets rid of meaning. But, you ask, without words and without meaning, where is the poetry? To this I reply, get rid of words and get rid of meaning, and still there is poetry.
Is that true for you?
I think it is both a poem of great puzzlement, and also I can say, yes, it is true for me. In a way, I've made it easy from what I was saying a few minutes ago when I say that poetry lives first in the world, and the poet's job is only to transcribe it into words and meanings, that you don't feel as though it's something that you make or you own or you even create. You feel as though it's there. And as I said before, our job is almost a job of translation. Mm-hmm. And if there were nothing there to translate, we couldn't make it up. It reminds me also of a quote of Voltaire's that I refer to in one of my own poems, where he said, if God did not exist, we would have to invent him. Mm-hmm. You know, you get the feeling that however one describes it, in whatever system one describes it, that there is something there before us which is the source and ground of everything we do. And that poetry is so much, it feels so much wiser than you feel you yourself could be, or any human being could be. That there is a repository before us that we only draw upon, mm-hmm. and through the quality of our attention, bring into words, bring into meaning, but that something is there first.
And you see that wisdom is out there, too.
Yes.
Like poetry is out there, too.
Yes. As I think the anthropologist Gregory Bateson would describe it, we tend to describe things in a reified way, as objects that we act upon. This is how our language treats the world. And he says quite wonderfully, I just learned this, that it's because we have hands that we have this kind of language, because we have hands which pick up objects.
My cup.
Yes.
My chair.
Yes, we ended up with a language which describes the world that way. But he says closer to the truth of how nature actually works would be a description which was in terms of relationship, that everything exists only as relationship, that to say thing is so dependent on a human point of view. Mm. You know, for example, I like to imagine we see a cup, but if you were looking from the point of view of an atom in that cup, you wouldn't see a cup. You would only see your relationship to the few things right around you, and you would see a great transparency and openness, a universe, many universes, where you and I see a cup. And so I think if you see it all as relationships in which we are only one part, you can't possibly stop and own it from a human point of view. On the other hand, one has to be very faithful as a writer to the human point of view. We are human beings, and we enjoy the world through human senses, human sense of play, human bodies, human sense of meaning. And so poetry is always about the human point of view. Mm-hmm. I just like to remember that that's not the only possible one. I like very much the sense that there is a wideness before and after us, and that we get to play for a moment in the middle of it, yeah. with words, with meaning, but that poetry is something which is much larger than just the human point of view. Poetry is almost a word for describing beauty, meaningfulness, connection, perception, insight. And there have to be many possible beauties and meanings and insights, not just ours. I'm sure there's a poetry of elk. There's a poetry of whales. Mm. You know, I'm sure they have their own poetries.
All right. Now, this is a question of the street rather than a question of the cloud, then. What happens to the Jane Hirschfield who gets tired, has headaches, has moods, jealousies?
Mm-hmm.
Are those flies on the line, bait on the line?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of the main themes in my next book, which, of course, you've never seen, so you wouldn't know. But I became very interested in exploring the fact that all the things which are hard for us are also sources of meaning, are also sources of instruction to us. And that especially, you know, the hardest might be the small irritations. You know, difficult to make poetry out of the little irritations, the little fatigues. But the large ones, the great anger, the great loneliness, the great sorrow, the great pain, the great jealousy probably even, these are the very stuff of poetry. And of course, if you can make a poem from what causes you such suffering, in a way you found a way to work with the suffering and to reframe it into something which feels like it's all quite worth it. That we wouldn't... We're lazy creatures. I'm a lazy creature. You know, it would be easy to nap and watch television and read magazines and let one's life pass. But fortunately, life is very hard for us. And when we feel these hard things, you have to deal with it. You can't watch television when you're in terrible pain. You simply can't. Mm. You have to deal with the pain. And that makes us more deeply human. It forces us to confront ourselves, to look at our lives. And for me, the way I look at my life is poetry, because that's the path I've chosen. For me, poetry is the main way that I explore, examine, feel more deeply, test more widely, and find out what it is to be the same Jane Hirschfield who gets tired and frustrated and irritated. You know, who is she? I find that out by writing more than any other way.
Can we take a moment and look to a poem so the audience may see and hear?
Mm-hmm.
All right. From the book of Gravity and Angels, we're talking about kind of the human peaks and depths. Mm-hmm. So maybe heat. Mm-hmm. Would be a good poem, too.
Or maybe heat wouldn't, since that's in terms of an animal. Maybe For What Binds Us would be a good one for what we've just been talking about.
All right. I don't want to lose heat.
Okay.
Because, we can speak about why in a minute here. This is Jane Hirschfield, once again, while she looks for her poem and then tells me where it is.
Okay, page 34.
Thank you. The book is Of Gravity and Angels, and it is published by Wesleyan Press. We are turning to page 34. Yes. Okay.
For What Binds Us. There are names for what binds us. Strong forces, weak forces. Look around. You can see them. The skin that forms in a half-empty cup, nails rusting into the places they join, joints dovetailed on their own weight. The way things stay so solidly, wherever they've been set down, and gravity, scientists say, is weak. And see how the flesh grows back across a wound with a great vehemence, more strong than the simple, untested surface before. There's a name for it on horses when it comes back darker and raised. Proud flesh. As all flesh is proud of its wounds, wears them as honors given out after battle, small triumphs pinned to the chest. And when two people have loved each other, see how it is like a scar between their bodies, stronger, darker, and proud. How the black cord makes of them a single fabric that nothing can tear or mend. I thought of that poem because it is a poem which came out of a tremendous state of grief, you know, the end of a very long relationship. The second section in this book is the story of a relationship which, you know, begins and reaches its peak and ends. And for me, this poem was written out of, you know, sort of devastation. I was not in good shape. And yet, you know, to wake up in the middle of the night, as I did in this case, with the poem practically saying itself in me, was both a way to enter that feeling, but also, as the poem shows, to resolve it, to find a way to accept it and have it become something other than simply itself. It became something which helped me find meaning in what I was going through, and then one hopes might find others who find themselves in similar situations, deal with the fact that, you know, love never ends, it can't be torn, and yet when it's broken, it can't quite be put back together either, and you're left in that paradox. I often find my poetry, my titles often have paradoxes in them, of gravity and angels, you know, the ink dark moon for the translation. I think paradox is very close to the truth of our lives, that it's not one thing or another, but both. It's not just grief, but it's grief and love. It's not just love, but it's love and inevitable loss. That the thing which wounds us ends up knitting us together more strongly, as this poem talks about, than if we had never been broken. The Japanese aesthetic of beauty shows this a lot. The cracked, mended, ancient teapot is what's considered beautiful, not the perfected, young thing. This is a great difference between some Western aesthetics and Japanese aesthetics. They value the signs of use, the signs of wear in an object. And I think we need to learn to value that in our own lives, that we need to learn that it's the very things which mark us and scar us which also create the human being who has lived rather than a human being who hasn't.
You write of that in another poem where you speak of a cracked cup not as something that's flawed, but as a sign of something that's seasoned.
Yes.
And then compare it to the pleasure you take in your lover who is not a virgin, a seasoned lover, a seasoned cup.
Right.
We are all in some ways cracked a bit, marred a bit if we have lived, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And the world is cracked and marred, and we love it as it is. We find, I've been talking with friends about aging recently, and isn't it interesting that we find an old, gnarled tree the most beautiful tree, and yet in ourselves we don't want to become that old, gnarled tree. If we could only learn to treat ourselves the way we treat everything we look at, you know, that the signs of wear are the very signs of beauty, it would probably be easier for us.
Probably easier.
Would you like me to read Heat now? I didn't mean to deflect the conversation.
No, that's all right. And yes, I would. And because it's such a clear sign of how you reach out into the world to show what is inside.
Yes.
So in that light, let's take a look at the poem called Heat. And this one's on page 17.
Thank you. My mare, when she was in heat, would travel the fence line for hours, wearing the impatience in her feet into the ground. Not a stallion for miles, I'd assure her. Give it up. She'd widen her nostrils, sieve the wind for news, be moving again, her underbelly darkening with sweat. Then stop at the gate a moment, wait to see what I might do. Oh, I knew how it was for her, easily recognized myself in that wide lust. Came to stand in the pasture just to see it played. Offered a hand, a bucket of grain, a minute's distraction from passion, the most I gave. Then she'd return to what burned her, the fence, so hoping I might see, might let her free. I'd envy her then, to be so restlessly sure of heat and need, and what it takes to feed the wanting that we are. Only a gap to open the width of a mare. The rest would take care of itself. Surely, surely, I knew that, who had the power of bucket and bridle. She would beseech me, sidle up, be gone, as life is short. But desire, desire is long.
The poem called Heat from Of Gravity and Angels. This poem has sweetness and humor and frustration. What I like best about it is that you leave the focus, you leave the camera, if you will, mm-hmm. on the mare. And yet we are left at the end, I think, knowing more about our own kind of rampant states, whether that's sexual or intellectual mm-hmm. or in any way. Mm-hmm. Is this absolutely on purpose?
That oh, yes.
That you look always at the mare, but we are left with our humanness?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think that one of the best ways to write poetry, and there are many ways to write poetry, but one of the best ways is to show rather than tell the situation, the experience that you're meaning to convey, that you're meaning to explore, to find in the outside world, or rather, I mean, I say to find in, and I hear that actively, but I mean it through listening, mm-hmm. To perceive in the outside world, this is going back to our hook and our lake, which came first, that wisdom is all around us, human nature is all around us, we see our own emotions in everything, we see our own situations in everything, because of course we're part of everything. But by giving you a mirror to look at, I'm giving you a way to find for yourself, as the reader, your own experience of that situation, rather than me dictating to you what it might be, rather than spelling it out. There wouldn't be any interest in that or any mystery left in it. Whereas by turning to the outside world for our speaking, we are able to leave an openness for each reader to bring into that whatever they come with, and to make of it their own meaning as I made of it mine. That the situation was rich for me. In the actual, it's a poem that came out of, you know, quite literally, I did do everything which is said in here, and she did do everything she was doing. And as I found in it richness and meaning, one hopes that other people will as well.
You mentioned this just a moment before. Do you write for me as well as for yourself? Do you want to show me that mare? Or are you writing because Jane and the mare are writing this poem together?
Right, a very good question, and of course different poets will have different answers.
Yes.
I write primarily for my own way of learning, way of knowing, so I write primarily for me. But what happens is once you begin to publish, you're always aware that there is a reader there and they need to be taken care of, and all the issues of craft are good for not just for writing for you, writing for others, but also for helping me clarify my own thinking. If I take care of a possible reader when I revise a poem, because of course for first draft is simply me thinking, as I said, I couldn't possibly consider what audience this poem might have while I'm writing my first draft. But then as I work on them, I do consider, how would this poem look to someone who'd never seen it before, who'd never had the experience? Have I taken care of them? Have I given them enough information to see the mirror as I did? And that doesn't just help me make a better poem for you, it helps me make a better poem for me too. It helps me clarify my own envisioning of this thing in the world that was first in the world, but then you remake it within yourself, and that makes it more intimate for you, that you've recreated it within.
We are here leaping a wide gulf between questions, but is that even more powerfully so when you are translating the works of two ancient Japanese poets into English? You're bringing them through you to me?
Yes, I am, but I'm also it feels like it's putting me a little too forward in the equation, in a way, to say that. Of course, that's what translation is. One is a medium, or a midwife, perhaps.
Midwife.
But it more feels as though, again, you know, I did this book, yes, because I thought the world should know these poets. They're the two foremost women poets in Japanese literature, and only a handful of poems had been translated into English, and I had read that handful 15, 16 years before and wanted to see more of them. And no one had done it. I kept waiting for someone else to do this book, which I had thought in 1971 should be done. But I also did the book because I wanted to read more of their poems, and it was the only way I could do it, was by finding a Japanese co-translator and doing it so that I could have that pleasure. It sounds, in a way, I sound like quite a selfish poet, you know, but it's more, I think, if one is honest to one's own curiosity and one's own exploration, one then turns it into a gift. One then tries to give it back to the world because you're grateful for how much has been given you. It would have been terrible if I'd simply done these translations and not tried to publish it. That would have been a rejection of the gift of these poets who wrote the poems in the first place and gave them to the world, allowed them to see their own most intimate moments and emotions and feelings and thoughts. There's a wonderful book by Lewis Hyde called The Gift Must Always Move, in which he says this is the very nature of art, that what feels as though it comes to you as a gift from the muse, you must then turn around and give it to somebody else, or the stream will be dammed, and streams want to flow.
Huh. This is true of so many things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the gift, life, the heart, it all must pass through. Huh. Jane Hirschfield is our guest today on Conversations. The book to which we are most recently referring is The Ink Dark Moon. It is a book of translations by Jane Hirschfield and by Mariko Aretani.
Yes.
Good, I pronounced that correctly. Of love poems by Onoko Komachi and Izumi Shikibu.
Shikibu.
Shikibu, I'm sorry. Izumi Shikibu. Try to say it correctly, and sometimes it is lost. These are women of the ancient court of Japan. Their love poems, as Jane has said, lost to time, except for a few, until most recently.
Lost for time to us.
In Japan,
they have been read ever since they were written.
This is true, and this is the perspective of the West, isn't it?
Yes, it's all right.
Well, it's nice to be told to back off. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis with Jane Hirschfield. Introduce us to the ancient court of Japan. I want to preface it briefly. Our Western relationship with Japan in the late 20th century is restive, fraught, peculiar, competitive, envious, and odd. I don't know that we see this country clearly or that they see us clearly. So introducing us to the ancient court of Japan is, in an odd way, introducing us through an image that is already skewed. Mm-hmm. Is there any way to clear away the clutter?
I think what clears away the clutter is the poetry itself. What's wonderful about these poems is that even though they were written in a court culture wildly different to anything we have ever known in our lives, the women were dressed in 13 layers of silk kimonos. Their idea of beauty was to blacken their teeth. We want nice white teeth. For them, they would, you know, take some substance to make all their teeth black. They would whiten their faces radically. So we would find them, if we simply met one on the street, wildly alien to us. But if you read their poems, what you find is they are exactly like us. Their experiences are exactly like us. That's why I fell in love with them in the first place. I was 18 years old, having a wild, romantic life of my own, full of turmoil and ups and downs, thinking about the more metaphysical ideas which sometimes come up in these poems, in that they're also Buddhist as well as love poems. And suddenly I found people phrasing my own deepest experience for me in ways that were utterly simple, utterly available, utterly true, utterly complex under that surface simplicity. And I recognized my own life in them. And I think this is very important. Between cultures, which are now mired in a kind of incomprehension and a kind of fear of each other because of the economic issues, to go back and realize that at some level all human beings have exactly the same hearts. They simply express them in different languages. That's what this poetry can do in terms of revising our skewed image of what Japan is.
Can we introduce through the poems? Are there poems in this book that were poems you fell in love with when you were 18?
Oh, yes.
Are they findable?
Yes. Let's see. Can I remember which they were? There is a very famous one of Komachi's, which I know I would have seen. Okay, here's one. It has to do with... Does it need any explanation? Let me see. The poet is waiting for a lover who she rarely saw. Komachi is a legend to us. We know very little about her. She was supposed to be the greatest writer of her time, the most beautiful woman of her time. She was supposed to have had many lovers, but also clearly from the poems, there was one who she longed for and didn't get to see very often. And then, according to legend, she ended her life a half-mad old hag living outside the walls of the capital in a thatched hut, but still writing great poems and wise in the ways of Buddhism. So she's a wonderful proto-feminist figure. This poem shows her wondering, will she see her lover? It talks about the spring flowers fading. And I think one thing most people do know about Japan is their great love, you know, since the earliest times, for seeing the plum blossoms, seeing the cherry blossoms, and finding the greatest beauty in the fact that there's this explosion of fragile loveliness which vanishes almost at once. So she's reflecting on her own life, passing, fading, unseen as the cherry blossoms are because it's raining. While watching the long rains falling on this world, my heart, too, fades with the unseen color of the spring flowers. So that feeling we've all known of something is being wasted and we can't bear it. We watch, it's raining, we can't go outside, our lover isn't coming, we're getting old in her case. The simplicity and the poignance of her situation. Another one which I would have known when I was quite young is the first one of hers that I translated, which has no imagery, unusually for Japanese poetry. Did he appear because I fell asleep thinking of him? If only I'd known I was dreaming, I'd never have wakened. That's a moment of passion that every one of us recognizes.
Wonderful romance, wonderful passion, yes. She speaks about dreaming a lot.
Yes.
She hides from her lover in dreams or is unable to see him in dreams.
Mm-hmm.
She goes to dreams to find him when she can't see him in this life,
in
the waking life.
Something I've done myself.
Yes. Yes. Was also her dream world more real than our end of the 20th century Western dream world? Did she see it as...
Well, the question of, in one poem she says, is this reality or dream? That's a very Buddhist question. You know, the famous story of Chuang Tzu dreamt that he was a butterfly and woke up. He's actually a Taoist philosopher. He dreamt he was a butterfly, he awakened, and then he wondered, now am I a butterfly dreaming that I'm Chuang Tzu? The whole question of what is reality is a deeply Buddhist question and is explored again and again in these poems. And to that extent, it's a pressing issue for her because it's a pressing metaphysical issue. But was her dream life different than ours? I think, you know, no. Not for those of us for whom our dream life is important, as it is for me. I mean, I consider dreams a form of working through and thinking and understanding my life just as poetry is. I love dreams.
Mm-hmm. I'm asking this about both poets, Shikibu and Komachi. Were they revered and adored in their own lives? In some ways, their lives were quite embattled. They made decisions that other people didn't like and flouted their sexuality and their lovers.
Right. But they were, because they were great poets and acknowledged as such while they were alive, yes, they were revered and perhaps given more room to flaunt social mores, to behave unconventionally because they were recognized as being writers. This is the only period in the world where women writers created the great golden age of literature, as if Shakespeare or Cervantes had been a woman. You can also think of them, as we sometimes think of Sappho, as, you know, the creators of a kind of lyric poetry which didn't exist before them. So it's quite an extraordinary period, and something that, you know, I think Americans should know about, especially American women, who sometimes feel as though the current feminist movement is doing something which has never been before. I've heard women older than I complain that they felt that they were having to write with no ancestresses. But we had ancestresses. There have always been women who wrote. They might have had a harder time in many cultures, but in this one they didn't. In this one, women actually had equality as artists.
What made room for women to become artists, and the best artists?
Two accidents coming together at the same time. One was because it was a court culture rather than a military culture, which is what followed, and women's status plummeted after this period in Japan. But because it was a court culture, the arts were held in high regard, and everyone throughout the culture practiced the arts, not only writing poetry, although that was the foremost, but also playing musical instruments, dance, mixing of incense, calligraphy. So you had that.
The richest and the poorest?
I don't know about the poorest. I think probably not. I think probably only the privileged had the luxury to do this. So the 5,000 people living within the court society, a tiny percentage, no doubt. Of course, we have very little record of the poorest. We do have folk songs. So perhaps, yes, that's an indication that even amongst the poorest, poetry was important. Songs of, you know, wives lamenting their soldier husbands being sent to the front and missing them, that kind of thing.
Okay. This is, so people will know, 800 to 1200 AD,
right, 400-year period.
And in what is modern-day Kyoto, Japan, is that
yes.
right?
Yes, yes. Then the other accident which allowed the women to step forward was that male writers were often doing their formal work in Chinese, the way that at certain periods in Europe, for example, all scholarly work was done in Latin, or in the English court for a long time after the Norman invasion, the high language was French. This left the women open to explore the vernacular, Japanese. So they were doing all of their writing in Japanese because they didn't participate in the political life. That was one place where there was not egalitarianism between the sexes. And so they had a freer field to write only in their home language, and so they did it a bit better than the men who had divided allegiances in their writing.
And did they in that way place their stamp on?
Yes, absolutely. The world's earliest novel is a book called The Tale of Genji, and that was written in this court in the year 1000, and is a huge book. You know, it's well over 1,000 pages in translation. And this was done by one of these court women who was, you know, a marvelous writer with a marvelous imagination and had both the education and the luxury of time to pursue it. And, you know, all of Japanese literature from that time has roots in The Tale of Genji.
Jane Hirschfield here on Conversations. We're looking at a book again called The Ink Dark Moon. Will you read for us again? You have read some of Onono Komachi. Now, Izumi Shikibu.
Yes, a few poems of hers.
All right. She also served, so to speak, at court.
Yes. 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 And she is considered, Komachi, we have only 100 of her poems left. Shikibu, we have over 1,000. And she is considered the major woman poet of the tradition.
Not just because of output, but...
Oh, no, because of quality.
Yes.
Lying alone, my black hair tangled, uncombed, I long for the one who touched it first. Why haven't I thought of it before? This body, remembering yours, is the keepsake you left. In this world, love has no color, yet how deeply my body is stained by yours.
love poems were something at this time that were written about every aspect of loving and sent as messages, yes?
Yes.
This
yes.
is important.
Absolutely.
Why did they write so many love poems? Because this mm-hmm. was part of the culture.
It was the entire way that courtship was conducted. It's quite wonderful. I'd love to see it come back amongst American relationships. It would really be really something. When a man became interested in a woman, he would let her know this by sending her a poem. Not only the best poem he could write, but also one on paper which was carefully chosen with carefully done calligraphy and with an appropriate, perhaps, plum blossom or branch of autumn leaves attached to it. He would send it to her by means of a messenger page, who would then wait for the woman to compose an answer. If she was impressed by the poem and had perhaps heard something about the man and was interested, she would write a poem of her own, which through its imagery would encourage him. He might then show up that very night at her door.
Ardent.
Yes, they would spend the entire night not primarily, perhaps, exchanging poems, quoting old poems to each other, discussing the merits of autumn and spring and which was the more poignant season. And sort of incidentally, somewhere in there, they would make love. It was considered very bad manners to fall asleep at all, especially on the first night. One must stay up all night. And then, because even though everyone was having these relationships, they were conducted under a code of secrecy, in the first glimmerings of light at dawn. It would be very hard in summer in Alaska, wouldn't it? You'd have quite a short time to get all of this done.
Ah, but winter.
He would then, put back his 12 layers of kimonos and go off through the dew-wet grass. And then, before going off to court to work, he would send what was called a morning-after poem. The woman would reply to that, and only then was the night considered complete. It wasn't just in the realm of love. Also, in any realm, the sending of a poem was a major form of communication. So if you were going to send a condolence note, you would often do it in the form of a poem. If you were going to an official reprimand from one government official to another might be done in the form of a poem. It was ubiquitous. Huh.
We must talk at some point about the process of translation, because this had to be fairly extraordinary.
It was.
Do you speak Japanese?
I know a great deal about the grammar, and I know some vocabulary, but I do not speak Japanese, and I cannot read one character. This is why I had a co-translator.
Blessings on her.
Well, yes. Oh, she was wonderful, wonderful co-translator. What we would do would be once a week we would meet, and she would give me, we had the collected poems of both women, she would give me a sight translation, and if I thought the poem would have a chance of coming into English, and not all poems do, some depend on puns, on place names, things like that, but if it seemed like it might make a poem in English, we would then write down the Japanese in our alphabet, and below each word write down a corresponding cue for what it means, one word or a cluster of words. Mm-hmm. And then I would go away with, 20 or 30 of these each week, and during the week I would see which ones I could translate, which ones might make poems in English. And something very mysterious happens in this process. Because what you will do when you're translating is you must immerse yourself in the original. You must see what it says, feel what it says, become intimate with that. But then there's a moment of letting go where everything vanishes and it reconstitutes itself within you. A poem in English will come up to answer what existed in this different grammar, different sound system, different beauty of music, all of that. And there has to be a moment of disappearance, I think, in the beginning, because if you cling too tightly, you will translate too literally, and it will be dead. There will be no life in it. The poem has to grow, as it grew originally out of the poet's heart and mind, it has to also grow anew in the translator's heart and mind.
And the process of immersion is the process of faith, that you will be
That's the process of letting go, is the faith, that it will come over. The process of immersion, I would say, is dwelling very, very closely with their images, with their words. That's when you step into the river on one shore, and you get very, very familiar with that shore, and then you go swimming across, and new trees appear on the other side, because English is very unlike Japanese. And there are choices which have to be made in English which don't happen always in Japanese poems. Poems which I've translated with I or you. In Japanese, there might be no such grammar. It's not needed. But we use that grammar. We have to use that grammar. And so I would need to choose whether the poem would be first person, second person, third person. And I would choose by which felt to me that it gave the same effect as I had felt in that Japanese poem, which moved me the most.
Did you exist for whole days with words and emotions just rolling through you?
Yes.
Selecting this one, no, that's not right. Yes. Well, it's almost there,
oh,
I
yes,
can taste it.
Yes, it was haunting. I couldn't stay away from it.
Yeah.
And the result was, for a whole year, you know, I felt as though I was in love all year because I was so immersed in this material. And I was also in love with the poems and in love with the process of translating and in love with the challenge of it. And it was one of the most splendid years of my life. To be given such richness to work with, and to be able to puzzle my way through it and swim in it and dance with it. It's a wonderfully rewarding thing to do. And then, you know, later to be made so happy by the fact that people actually wanted this work and that it has become meaningful in a lot of people's lives. I've heard of people who courted their soon-to-be husbands or wives by giving them this book. People who've had the poems read at their weddings. Lots and lots of stories have come back to me, and I'm so grateful.
There's a sad one, but a striking one that you told me the other night about someone who told you that she had...
Oh, yes, that is a sad story. It stunned me. A woman who told me that she had made the final decision to divorce her husband after reading this book.
Because of this book.
Because it had made so clear to her what she wanted in her life, which was missing from it. And I was, you know, awed and chastened to think that I might have had anything to do with this. But, of course, I didn't. Komachi and Shikibu did.
The power of words.
Well,
I don't know, maybe the power of the heart.
Mm-hmm. And the power of intimacy. I mean, one thing about poetry is it does give one intimacy into strangers' hearts. Mm. It's one of the few places where people reveal themselves utterly in their great sorrows and their great joys in a way that 1,000 years later, an absolute stranger can see that and be so deeply affected by it that they change their lives.
It sets aside this belief that we cannot walk in each other's shoes, that I can't know you because I was not raised in your place, of your faith, of your emotion. It puts that aside, doesn't
yes.
it? It says, yes, I
yes.
can.
It
we
shows
can reach.
The places where we are universal. I think there's a great particularity to human life, and there's also a great universality to human life. And the job of poetry is to go back to our idea of, you know, why in heat was I writing through the mayor in order to talk about things. What poetry does is, by giving you something very, very particular, it presents the universal through it, which is the only way the universal ever lives. Love and mourning don't live in the abstract. They live in particular lives, in particular situations. And the great strength of Japanese poetry is that it always presents a particular situation. It's never general. It's always precise, in one moment.
Does its brevity also contribute to its ability to evoke?
I think so. And I think it contributes, the combination of absolute compression and also the fact that in most of the poems it works through imagery makes it a very translatable poetry in the way that some others are not. Mm-hmm. These are poems which do travel between grammatical systems and between cultures because of the quality of poetry that they are. Easier, I think, to translate these poems than to translate Renaissance Italian sonnets
in which so much of the beauty of them resides in the sound, in the rhyme, in the way the Italian works. And when you lose that music, you lose the life of the poem itself.
So the Japanese poetry reaches through and past the device to whatever the core is.
Or it uses a device which is easily remade in English. It's hard to duplicate sound. You can only make another sound and hope it's as beautiful. And I do care about the sound in these poems. I tried to make poems which sound beautiful in English, whose rhythms are beautiful, whose consonants and vowels are beautiful. But it's not the same sounds as the Japanese has and cannot be. But the image, when a poet talks about a particular pine tree green in spring, that's the same in Japanese as in English. That doesn't get lost.
Jane Hirschfield with us on Conversations. Has this process of translation changed your notions of translation? Did you go in thinking one thing about translation and ability to translate and come out thinking another?
Well, I certainly went in never thinking that I would ever translate anything. I did not set out to be a translator. I think it opened me more to, I had thought, and I actually still think, it's a bit paradoxical, I think it's better if you are a scholar of the language you're translating from. I still have that prejudice. On the other hand, everyone knows poetry should be translated by poets, and I think I gained more faith in the ability of poet to know poet, even through the intermediary of a wonderful language person serving as informant. And Mariko was, of course, much more than just a language person. She also presented aspects of the culture to me, and she herself is an extraordinary woman with the great ability to convey subtle details, as well as simply historical background, that I think even if I'd studied Japanese for 15 years, how could I know the culture the way that someone who grew up in it would know it? So it gave me a more open feeling about translation, more freedom, more belief in freedom than I might have had before, that there's a fidelity to the seed and the heart of a poem, which is the most important thing, and everything else exists in the service of that. I became more confident in that belief from having gone through this myself.
And did this change your own writing? Is this next book of poems transformed by the book of translations?
A little less than it would have been, because I was so transformed by having read Japanese literature in translation back when I was 18. Mm-hmm. That was the main place where this way of writing entered my own work, so it's been with me a long, long time. And that, in fact, may have also been one reason why I felt it was all right for me to do this translation, was that I had such long sympathy with their kind of poetry and their concerns in poetry. What it changed a bit was my process, in that it gave me a deeper sense of freedom to try saying things a different way. Because when you translate some of these poems, I came up with as many as 8 different versions, all of which I liked, all of which were true to the original, because, of course, you're always choosing between one nuance and another when you translate. And I think some of that came into my own work, so that I revise with a much greater sense of freedom now to go for a different word, try a different construction. It opened me up, gave me a certain detachment from my own first draft, so that I could treat that the way that I had treated these, and know that it would always be there to go back to again. If you get lost, you simply return to the source, and the source will always give you another place to go.
A little more playful?
Yes.
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 Let me take a moment to reintroduce Jane Hirschfield. The books out, present, and in your bookstore or your library are Of Gravity and Angels, Poetry by Jane Hirschfield, published by Wesleyan University Press in 1988. This book of poetry has, one, been awarded the Commonwealth Club of California's 1988 Poetry Medal. Another book out in your library, in hardback or soft, is called The Ink Dark Moon, Poems by Onuno Komachi and Izumi Shikibu. These are two court poets from ancient Japan. It's translated by Mariko Aratani, and you can find it in hardback by Scribner's, published in 1988, probably in your library, and the expanded version, Vintage Classics by Random House, came out in 1990. That's a softback book. Now forthcoming, Women in Praise of the Sacred. Jane Hirschfield has been the editor for 43 centuries of spiritual poetry by women. We should not take that quite literally. The subtitle of the book, Women in Praise of the Sacred, is 43 centuries of spiritual poetry by women. That book will come out by HarperCollins in 1994. Also coming out in 1994, The October Palace, the latest book of poetry by Jane Hirschfield, will be published by HarperCollins. This is definitely an award-winning poet. I meant to tell you about her many awards, grants, fellowships, and the like, but we have had more time to speak to each other, which has been nice. If you ever are in a master's program in writing at the University of San Francisco, you might find Jane Hirschfield as your teacher. She is faculty there when she is not writing. We have moments left, and I wonder if you would read again. I'm torn between the poems, actually, of Shikibu in towards the end of her life, where she is both mourning the death of her daughter and mm-hmm. also thinking about her own transcendence, the end of her own life. Well, perhaps we could just be there. Would that be all right?
Yes.
If we look back to about page 139 of The Ink Dark Moon, and then we can just skip to where you might want to go.
Okay.
To a couple of poems. The Morning of Naishi also is a little further along.
All right, I'll read you that poem first. Good. Naishi was Shikibu's daughter, who grew up, came to court, became a poet of some standing in her own right, and then died in childbirth. This poem has a prose headnote which Shikibu would have written. It says, "Around the time Naishi died, snow fell, then melted away. Why did you vanish into empty sky? Even the fragile snow, when it falls, falls in this world." And I'll read you. Do we have time for one more or a few more?
Phew.
Some of the poems that Shikibu wrote after the great love of her life, Prince Atsumishi, died, so more mourning poems. "Twilight and the path you took, coming and going from me, is also gone, woven closed by spider webs and sorrow. Remembering you, the fireflies of this marsh seem like sparks that rise from my body's longing. It would console me if you returned, even for the length of the flash, seen and then gone, of lightning at dusk. Mm. Those nights when we slept behind love's jeweled screen, were we even aware of the opening dawn skies?" And I'll finish with what's supposed to have been Shikibu's final poem, written on her deathbed and sent to a Buddhist priest who was her teacher, and it helps in reading this poem to know that the moon is a symbol of Buddhist enlightenment. "The way I must enter leads through darkness to darkness. O moon above the mountain's rim, please shine a little further on my path."
The poetry of Izumi Shikibu, as read by Jane Hirschfield. Jane, thank you for a fascinating hour.
Thank you.
This has been Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. Please join me again next week.